I'm very happy now to welcome John Pepper. He's an evolutionary biologist at the National Cancer Institute, and he's external faculty here at the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much, Mary Charlotte.
So you are an evolutionary biologist, and the understanding of evolution can help us to understand both the nature of healthy organisms and cancer. Let's talk for a moment about single-celled organisms and their evolution to multi-celled organisms that are made up of, whether it be earthworms or us, made up of cells that have different functions. When you've got a bunch of little cells swimming around in primordial soup, each one of them is basically what? Pursuing its own self-interest?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to put it. Let me back up and put this in context by saying that when we talk about single cells, we're talking about almost all of the history of life on Earth. Us multi-celled organisms like worms and people are the latest and greatest thing, but life on Earth, for most of the history of the planet, was single cells in the oceans. And some cells survived and managed to reproduce themselves, others didn't. And generally, the ones that survive and reproduce are the ones that are good at pursuing their own interests, getting the resources they need, the food, oxygen, whatever they need to survive. The ones that don't survive, and so they don't pass on their genes, and ones like them are not present the next year or the next generation. So after a while, all you see are the ones that are good at getting what they need. So self-interest tends to be the default when we look in biology. Not universally, of course, because cells do cooperate with each other, and other organisms do too. Darwin made a very convincing argument for why, basically the same argument I just sketched, why we do expect to see self-interest in nature, and we do see a great deal of it. But if we think that's the end of the story, we're going to be very surprised when we go out and look at nature, because sure, we see lots of self-interest, lots of organisms that are exquisitely doing whatever they need to do to get what they need to survive and reproduce. But we also see all sorts of cooperation, elaborate forms of cooperation. So there certainly is more to the story.
So do you see elaborate forms of cooperation in that long history of life on Earth, which was just single, not just, but was single-celled organisms?
Well, no, we don't really. We're not really able to see that in the fossil record. But when we look at single-celled organisms that are alive today, we do see a lot of cooperation.
And how does that work? In other words, bacteria, for example, cooperating with each other?
Absolutely, yeah. Bacteria are the first example I would have brought up. Bacteria can live as solitary cells. We usually refer to them as being single-celled. But they also form communities that are very cooperative, where bacteria create what we call a biofilm, a living film. And the film is bacteria and some substances they secrete that's a matrix for them to live in. And they're sort of building their own environment when they do this. You could think of them as microscopic beavers. Beavers build their own environment by damming a creek, and then a whole family of beavers will live in the resulting pond and cooperate with each other. They'll build a lodge together. They'll go out and cut down trees together. So they build their environment and they share it and improve it. And bacteria do the same thing by building biofilms and living in and cooperating in them. And this is a big problem for us in some ways. Biofilms are on our teeth and they help bacteria to give us cavities. Biofilms are in our bodies when we get bacterial infections and they help the bacteria resist antibiotics. So
we also have lots of very friendly bacteria in our guts and stuff that help us digest.
That's right.
Do they also cooperate with each other?
Well, the research focus there has been more on how they cooperate with their host, which is an extremely important topic for medicine these days. This is a world we're just beginning to explore. There's a whole community, there's thousands of species living inside us. They've always been there throughout, as long as there have been humans. And they're extremely important to our health in ways we're just starting to understand. So some of these bacteria are probably cooperating with each other. Some are probably competing with each other. It's an ecosystem that we're just starting to look at.
How did single cells going around in the oceans for untold millennia, evolve into multicellular organisms?
That's a wonderful question. And we've done a lot of head scratching over that. And of course, we missed all the action. We weren't here to see it. So we work hard at digging up whatever clues we can find and trying to reconstruct things as best we can. But some of the clues are living things that are still present now. So if you look at a sponge, you could scratch your head for a long time. A sponge is not just something you use to take a bath, it's also a living thing in the ocean before that. And when you look at it in the ocean, you could scratch your head in a long time trying to decide, is this a multicellular animal or is this a colony of single-celled organisms? Because there are single cells, they've built their microenvironment, they like bacteria in a biofilm sort of, they build a structure that they're all going to live in, all these single cells. And each cell can reproduce, so in that way, they're like single-celled organisms that happen to be cooperating. But they do specialize just a little bit, depending on the species. Some, not much. So some sponges you could look at and say, well, this looks like a colony of single-celled organisms. Others, as you dig into the details, you might find reasons to say, I'm going to call this an animal. And in fact, biologists did decide this is not a colony of single-celled organisms, it's an animal. So that's the sort of a missing link between single-celled and multi-celled.
But that's, I mean, the thing that makes it an animal is that colony of single-celled organisms. It's not a colony anymore when some of them are doing one thing and some of them are doing another thing. Let's say one group is seeing and the other group is digesting. I mean, I don't think sponges have eyes, but it's that kind of specialization.
That's right, exactly right, yeah. And there are some sponges where there's so little specialization that it's, or you might see specialization only in one stage of the life cycle and not in another. So depending on how you look at things and how you draw your criteria, and there's a lot of wiggle room there.
And so from there, we go to much more specialization.
Right.
What are some examples of that?
I'll avoid getting into a lot of biological detail, but there are various other critters and I think you hit on the key point that do we see different kinds of cells specialized for different kinds of jobs and not distantly related from the sponges. We see a lot of other living things that where there is much more specialization. You don't have a bunch of cells that are all doing, each one doing everything, each one eating for themselves, each one reproducing for themselves. Instead, you have some cells that are full-time eaters, some cells that are full-time reproducers, and they have division of labor.
And so from there, pretty soon you're at fish, amphibians, pretty soon you're at human beings living in cities on the evolutionary scale.
Yeah, that's right.
And so the thing that is so interesting, which is leading up to, we're taking a path leading up to what it is that you're doing and looking at in cancer research, is that in, for example, human beings, you've got all kinds of cells which evolved from single cells that were running around pursuing their own self-interest, but now we live in multicellular organisms where their job is not just to pursue their own self-interest and keep living, but to contribute to the whole and do their job, and sometimes their job is to die.
Very often, yes. There's a lot of layers of control added into the genome of multicellular organisms that are contrary to the selfish self-interest of the cell. And that's the most dramatic example. There's a very specific set of molecular machinery built into every cell in our body, specifically for the purpose of allowing that cell to kill itself, which would be very bizarre in single-celled organisms. Turns out it's there in single-celled organisms too, and that's a real puzzle. I've written a little bit about that because that really is does seem paradoxical, and suggests that there may be much more cooperation and it may be much more important than we had suspected in some of these organisms.
And so, one of the things that you have in multicelled organisms like humans is all these safeguards so that cells don't keep on dividing and reproducing ceaselessly, because that, in fact, does turn into cancer when that happens.
That's right.
What are some of those safeguards?
Well, there's all sorts of signaling where cells can use chemicals to talk to each other, to signal back and forth to each other about what sorts of behaviors are appropriate at what stage. So during development, certain cells need to divide, even for trivial reasons like to separate our fingers. If you look during development, our hand starts out looking sort of like a paddle with some bones in it, but no space between the fingers. And then where those spaces between the fingers are going to be, the way they're separated is that the cells that need to are sent a signal, which they obey by dying, and that allows the fingers to separate. And this kind of thing happens a lot during development. And as an adult, when development is complete, cells will die to protect the organism. If a cell is infected with a virus and it detects that, it can help to remove that threat to the body by killing itself and the virus along with it.
And so those are some of the ways in which the overall health of the organism, and in the case of development, the development of an organism and all these different traits that we have, that's the way it works. It is that there are all these signals of which cells should reproduce, which cells should stay the way they are, and which cells should die.
That's right. So I started with signals for dying. There's also signals for staying alive. And some we get a clue that it's really critical to control this. So there's multiple layers of control. There are signals for cell suicide. There are also signals for cell survival. And in some cases, the body is constantly sending a signal to the cells saying, stay alive, stay alive. And as soon as that signal stops, that's all it takes for a cell to kill itself. So it's almost as if the thing was set on a hair trigger with multiple layers. If anything doesn't seem right, it's better for some cells to kill themselves than to run any risk of uncontrolled proliferation and resulting cancer.
How old is cancer? What records do we have of how far back it's gone? I mean, it's obviously a phenomenon of multi-celled organisms, and it doesn't happen in plants. What animals historically and currently get it?
Well, it seems to be more prevalent in some than others, but where we find it is any animal that is able to regenerate its tissues because that requires cells that can continue to proliferate throughout the life of the organism. So if we get a wound or rub some skin off, our cells proliferate and replace the lost cells. Any animal that can do that, as a general rule, will be subject to at least a risk of cancer and some level of cancer incidence. So we see that in most all the animals that we're familiar with. It's common in all of our pets and most of the wild animals where we've been able to look for it.
Even like fish and spiders?
Okay, now you're testing my limits. I'm not sure about fish, and spiders have got me thinking because I suspect that spiders don't do much healing, much tissue self-renewal. And I think they may be in the sa therefore out of the danger zone for cancer.
Very interesting. So, do you have to have basically, you have to have blood vessels.
That helps a lot. Because cancer kills us partly by traveling through our blood. So any animal that didn't have a circulatory system would be at less risk.
Getting back to this whole question of the individual cell versus the multicellular organism, in the history of evolution, you have all these single cells that are perhaps to some extent, as you mentioned, cooperating with each other, but to a very large extent, proliferating as much as they can and evolving. And the history of those cells is in our own bodies. In our own bodies, in our human bodies, are cells also evolving?
When we're healthy, no. We're very carefully designed, with design in quotation marks. Sometimes people talk about natural design, and they're referring to adaptation by natural selection. So our body, one of the features that makes us work as a multicelled animal is that our cells are not evolving. And they're not evolving because there are very specific controls in place to prevent that from happening. When our cells evolve, that's very bad news for the future of the collective, the multicellular organism.
And so, examples of cells within our body evolving are, for example, tumors, and in fact, tumors can develop resistance to cancer drugs.
Absolutely, just like bacteria can. Anytime you have a population of cells that are variable, some survive and reproduce better than others. Some can withstand toxin or an antibiotic better than others, then as soon as you apply that drug, you're applying a selective force. You're changing their environment in a way that some can't survive, others can. And the survivors will inherit the earth or will inherit the infection in our bodies.
So, are all cancers based on cells that have mutated in some way?
It appears to be that way, yes. There's been a lot of focus recently on the genetics of cancer, and the short answer is yes. When we look at cancers, we see cells that have mutated. Often they've mutated not just in one or two ways, but in a huge number of ways. There's a whole project at the National Cancer Institute on the genomes of cancers, and the more we look, the more we find a huge and growing list of mutations that crop up in cancers.
So the body is continually fighting off and actually getting rid of mutant cells to the best of its ability.
That's right.
How does it do that?
Well, we know the immune system does some of that. Sometimes these cells become so abnormal, even though they all arise from normal cells and they all contain the human genome, so that makes it a harder problem. Something that's really alien, like a bacteria, a fungus, is so different from us at the molecular level that the body can easily recognize it as foreign and attack it with the immune system. Cancer cells are human cells and they start out as normal human cells. At some point, some of them acquire enough abnormalities that they become recognizable to the immune system as not being what normally should be there, and they can be attacked. And the immune system is a major line of defense against cancer.
Under what circumstances does the immune system fail?
That question is a major research agenda right now. We know that when, by the time we see full-blown cancer, we do know that the immune system has failed. And it's partly because the cancer has evolved ways of thwarting the immune system. So this is cell evolution versus cell evolution. Our immune system actually works partly by cell evolution within the body, and it's in a very controlled and channeled way. And the cancer is also driven by cell evolution. When the cancer wins this race, it can actually suppress or shut down the immune system, at least around the tumor, so that it avoids attack.
We're talking to evolutionary biologist John Pepper. When I look at your work and listen to you speak and look at this whole question of the single cells trying to survive and the multi-cells telling the single cells what to do, for all the world, it really sounds like the micro version of what happens in society, which is that you have all of us individuals hanging around by ourselves or in small groups or in families or in little subcultures, and then the larger society that essentially keeps us in check. And if we all do our jobs and do them well, we kind of survive, and when it's our time to die, we die. But if we, for example, like let's say I use all the water in Santa Fe to make a gigantic hydroponic orchid farm, they're going to come after me and I'm not going to be able to do that anymore. And that's the way of the society keeping the individual in check. Do you, as a biologist, do you think that way?
I do, yeah. It's impossible for me not to. And of course it's not new at all. People have always thought this way. Freud thought that the essence of the human condition was the conflict between the individual self-interest and the constraints of society. And he didn't write about it as a biologist, but it was the same issue.
And it raises just very interesting both biological and philosophical questions of what the term individual means. Like, what is the individual?
Yeah, that turns out to be such a thorny and interesting problem that I and a colleague wrote an entire paper about definitions of what is an individual organism, and concluding not just that there's one useful definition, but that depending on what you're trying to talk about, what kind of question you want to ask, you need to consider which of several available definitions you want to use. It's a big, messy, fun question.
And I suppose one could go on all sorts of tangents asking that same kind of question on a social level, you know, whether it's the person. I mean, obviously we have doctrines of individual rights, but we also have groups like families, and a family is a unit and stuff like that.
Sure. All sorts of levels of units, individuals, families, communities, and larger communities. And biology,
Cities,
yep, cities.
companies.
Biology is a bit like that. There's a whole hierarchy of nested layers of entities, if you will.
So you have, along all these issues that we've been talking about, made computer models to actually model the way that multicelled organisms work and how cancer grows and under what circumstances.
That's right.
What did you find?
Well, I started, in my own mind, I started with the question of why we get cancer, and thinking as someone trained as an evolutionary biologist, gravitated quite naturally towards this idea of natural selection and evolution among cells within the body, which was not novel with me. This idea had been proposed in the 70s. It hadn't really quite penetrated to the mainstream of cancer biology. So I was one of several people who sort of reinvented this idea and then found that it had been proposed before, as happens so often. And so that kind of satisfied me as an answer to why do people get cancer? And the logic was so compelling to me, especially because I was trained as an evolutionary biologist, that I said, well, sure, of course we get cancer. That's quite natural, and it almost seems quite inevitable when you really put all the pieces together, not just the theory, but what we see by actually looking at cancers and cancer cells and all the molecular pathways involved. It all fits together so well that I stopped wondering about why do some people get cancer, started wondering, how is it that some of us don't? It seems so inevitable, this whole process, that the variations will arise. Some of them will allow the cells to be more successful at surviving and reproducing. Those cells will gradually crowd out their competitors. Over some period of time, they'll dominate the population. They'll dominate the human tissue. They'll be all that's left. And then the process will repeat itself with another round of mutation and selection, more evolution. And as long as we're alive, this will continue. It's hard to see how it's not going to lead to eventually dismantling all of these layers of control that were built by the organism.
And those layers of control basically include listening to the instructions from the body.
That's right.
When the cell mutates to a point where it's not listening anymore, that's where it gets dangerous, and that's where cancer forms.
That's right.
So you made a model, and you started thinking is, how do any of us survive at all? How do any of us not get cancer?
That's right. And so from there, again, a natural progression from my background, I said, well, cancer is inevitable as long as this sort of Darwinian evolution process is occurring. So in the cases where cancer doesn't happen, it must be that this Darwinian evolution among cells in our body is not happening. How is that possible? And I started looking for ideas, talking to other people, trying to first just brainstorming and then trying to formalize ideas more and then to really make them formal. Can we represent this explicitly in a computer simulation and then use that to check the at least the logical consistency of the ideas? The ultimate test is, do the ideas match up with reality? But before we get to that test, we can say, do our ideas, are they internally self-consistent? When we put all our assumptions together, all our ideas about what causes what, when we assemble this into a system in a computer simulation, does it behave the way we expect? And does cancer arise under the conditions we would expect it to and not under the conditions we would not expect it to? So that was our exercise, our first exercise in trying to assess whether we're on the right track with the hypotheses we're proposing.
And
when we put it all together in a computer simulation, it acted a lot like we had expected it to, and we convinced ourselves that we were probably on the right track.
One of the things that, if I understand correctly, came out of that work was the understanding that as long as you have cells differentiating in the proper way, cancer never grows.
That's correct, yep. Differentiating means that when a cell divides, it produces two new cells that are different from the cell that divided. So that's where the word differentiate comes from.
And that's the norm?
It is the norm.
That's happening in our feet and stomachs and brains all the time?
Right. And that's another critical thing that marks a multicellular organism from a single cellular, which we talked about earlier. And single-celled organism, when one bacteria divides, it produces two new bacteria that are just like the one that divided. They carry the same genes, they have the same traits, there's no difference. And that's normal for all single-celled organisms. When rabbits have babies, the babies are rabbits. When squirrels have babies, the babies are squirrels. Inside our body, when a cell divides, the daughter cells, as we call them, the two new cells, are not just like the parent. They're different in ways that turn out to be critically important.
And that critical importance is part of what prevents cancer.
Right. So cell differentiation, of course, is how the organism gets built in the first place. Each of us started from a fertilized egg that was just one cell. But to be a human, we need to have thousands or millions of different kinds of cells. And these arise during development. When the parent cell divides into two that are different from the parent and sometimes also, at least different from the parent cell. So that happens over and over to create all the cell types. So it's obviously necessary to build the multicellular organism. But once the multicellular organism is built, you might say, okay, we don't need this process anymore, but it continues anyway. And it's happening in our bodies every minute of every day. If we look at our skin, it's a one immediately accessible example where our skin has layers with the cells at the bottom dividing to produce a different kind of cell in the next layer up. And there are multiple layers, each of which produces cells that are not like the parent cell, but are like the cells in the next layer up. So it's almost like an assembly line sort of situation.
When you have cells mutating, one of the things that happens is they can form growths that are not problematic, that are not these kind of crazy, ever-replicating cancer types of situations, but you might get a wart, or you might get a mole, or you might get some kind of little lumpy growth that my old dogs are covered with, and things like that that never hurt you. What is that, and how's that different from a cancer?
Right, that's a very important point. We do get all sorts of uncontrolled growths, and each of these, in some respects, is a breakdown of the normal control on cell proliferation. But they're not, like you said, they're not big medical problems. You get a wart, you can cut it off. You can just ignore it. It's not going to hurt you. All sorts of lumps and polyps. Sometimes we do have to remove them because they can progress on to become something that is dangerous, and ultimately they can progress on to cancer. But a lot of these lumps are benign, is the technical term. They're harmless because they stay put. Cancer cells don't stay put, so they're not benign. They're malignant. That means cells move out from those lumps into the surrounding tissues and invade the surrounding tissues.
And so that's really the big difference, is that movement from one place to another. If you've got a little wart or even a little benign tumor, it'll just sit there. But a cancer cell or a cancerous tumor keeps moving, growing, and eventually sending its agents out through the bloodstream to other parts of the body, where they then make new tumors all over again.
That's right. So it's a problem first locally, and then, as you point out, spreading to other parts of the body. Locally, a benign tumor will sit there. It might get big enough to be problematic, in which case a surgeon removes it and the problem's gone. That's not as effective with a cancer, because with a cancer you've got a lump that it's not just getting bigger with well-defined boundaries. Instead, it's sending out tendrils into the surrounding tissues. And individual cells actually can move out away from the mass into the surrounding tissues. And they get very good at this. And sometimes they do this in very destructive ways. So they sort of chew their way through the normal tissues. And this is what does the damage that can cause an organ to fail. And that's the defining feature of malignancy and of cancer. And that's the difference between a benign lump or a benign tumor and a malignant cancer.
And that brings up another important concept in evolutionary biology, which is, and again, the way you describe it in your work, what it sounds like is a tumor acts like a top carnivore who finishes eating all the prey in its ecosystem, eats out its entire prey base, and says, I've got to go somewhere else for food, and leaves the area to try to find other places to eat.
That's right. There are some species that are sort of good ecological citizens. They They consume available resources no faster than they're being produced, so they can stay put indefinitely and thrive there. Other species are very greedy, if you'll allow some anthropomorphism, and they gobble up resources so fast that they finally destroy the habitat that they depend on. The only way they can survive is to move on to greener pastures that they haven't already wrecked. And so we see species in nature that are perpetual invaders. They're always moving to new habitats. And that's one ecological lifestyle that we see in nature. And this is the ecological lifestyle that cancer adopts because it is so greedy and consuming the resources in its microenvironment, its microscopic environment within the body.
What does that suggest in terms of treatment?
Well, it shifts the focus a little bit from the growth of a lump, which is very easy to measure with available techniques, and so it tends to get a lot of focus. But once we recognize that the harm comes not directly from growth, but from this tissue invasion, it might lead us to shift our focus a little bit to the first strategy that medicine naturally gravitated to with a background of infectious diseases. Oh, it's a bad thing, we should kill it. That has worked great for a lot of infectious diseases. It has not worked as well for cancer, partly because it's human cells, so we can't just kill the foreign thing. But still, a lot of the early approaches to cancer were, and in many cases still are, how can we kill this thing? We can kill it with radiation. We can kill it with various kinds of cell toxins or cytotoxins that are more effective against the cancer than against the normal cells.
That's chemotherapy.
That's chemotherapy. And when we start thinking, well, the real problem is invasion, we might shift our thinking and say, okay, killing it has been difficult and problematic in various ways, some of which come back to the evolution of resistance. So are there alternatives to trying to kill it? And one is, can we just try to contain it, try to make sure it doesn't invade surrounding tissues and damage the body that way? The ultimate goal, of course, is not to kill the cancer, it's to save the patient. So I think we need to keep that firmly in mind. And it's easy to lose track of that sometimes when we have this mindset of killing the alien entity, which it's actually not.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important and interesting to think about what you said. Not only is it not an alien entity, it's a mutated version of ourselves, but it's really hard to go after it in that kind of battle metaphor because it is continually evolving, just like, as you said, bacteria that are producing resistant strains. And right. So your own cancer tumors, I mean, some people might take a drug that works the first time, but then it doesn't work the second time precisely because the process of evolution is working the way it's always worked.
Exactly right, yep. So the real problem is not what cancer is, it's how it behaves. So one social psychologist friend of mine who's also a cancer researcher says that cancer is not like an invading enemy horde, it's more like a criminal gang. The problem is not who they are, the problem is how they act. And if you go into a city and say, okay, we're going to kill all the criminals, that doesn't mean that there won't be criminals there next year, and it doesn't mean that there's going to be any way, easy way to sort out who you want to kill and who you don't. And that's a pretty good metaphor for the cancer situation.
I have to say, just as an aside, it sounds like, oh, let's go kill all the terrorists, which everybody knows doesn't work.
Yeah, I was trying to stay out of politics by not using that, but that's a more apt metaphor in a lot of ways. And people sometimes talk about, oh, this terrorist organization is metastasizing, and I think they're more accurate than they even need to be.
It's so interesting. I mean, as we evolve new forms of drugs and treatment and metaphors about disease that are actually effective, I wonder if that then bleeds out into law enforcement. I guess we'll see.
Yeah, time will tell.
Meanwhile, what are your hopes for the work you're doing? I mean, I guess one hopes not only to understand it, but to have that understanding result in ever more treatments.
Right. Or in my case, I'm fortunate to have ended up in exactly the right place for me professionally, because the more I understand about cancer, the more I'm convinced that cancer treatment tends to be a losing game in a lot of ways. It's a brutally difficult process to go through. It's difficult for the medical profession. It's a difficult problem to solve, and to be on the receiving end of of cancer treatment is not something that anybody ever wants to go through. Cancer treatment is difficult, it's unpleasant, it's hard on your quality of life, it's not as successful as we would like. And I think the only rational way to proceed, and many others have reached this conclusion, is to focus our efforts on cancer prevention. So I'm very lucky that I'm now working at NCI in the Division of Cancer Prevention. It's sort of as if we were saying, wow, look at all these people dying on the highways. We need to find some better way to treat crash victims. You could spend a lot of money on that, but if there's just as many crashes, you're never going to save everybody's lives, no matter how many ambulances you put on the road, no matter how good you get at emergency medicine. It's really much better to stop all the crashes.
And so there's a couple of ways, I'm guessing, that you're doing that. One is looking at how you prevent as many mutations as possible, and the other is how you keep the various safeguards that your body has evolved, how you keep those really working powerfully.
Right, that's right. And where my perspective has increasingly pushed me towards is thinking about what you just said, that mutations are the fuel of cancer, and how can we go to the source, reduce the rate of mutations, not the kind of mutations that are passed from parent to offspring, but the kind that are passed from parent cell to offspring cell within our organs and our tissues. And we're starting to understand better what causes them. We already knew, we had a long list of radiation that causes mutations, all kinds of chemicals that cause mutations. Now we have new ideas about how natural processes in the body, like various kinds of inflammation, cause mutations in our body cells. And one of my biggest interests now is understanding that better and devising better ways to watch for and to control inflammation before it persists long enough to provoke a cancer.
And meanwhile, are there research areas that are also focused on getting the body's immune system to work? I mean, we're living in a toxic environment. There's radiation in all sorts of places where there's not much we can do about it. We live in a place where some percentage of the houses are filled with radon, but the body does have mechanisms to do its job. Can those mechanisms be strengthened?
That's probably a good question. It's not one that I've made a focus, but I think there's a lot of good questions about, particularly about individual variation. There's some hints that some of us might be innately better at repairing this kind of damage in our genetic material than others. And that would probably be a productive avenue to pursue.
So at the National Cancer Institute, there's a lot of different divisions and a lot of different focuses, but in the long run, they're still going to try to come up with cancer treatments that are more effective and less arduous than what we have now.
Absolutely, yeah. My personal bias is definitely personally and professionally towards prevention, but we're obviously not going to abandon cancer treatment. We still need it. The utopic dream is that sometime in the future, we can forget about cancer treatment, but we're nowhere near that point now. We still need a lot of work on cancer treatment, and that definitely is an ongoing focus.
John Pepper is an evolutionary biologist at the National Cancer Institute. He's external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. Thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.